Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to live your life by design in 2009? Well, then sit back, relax, and enjoy an empowering conversation to advance and enhance your life. And now, your host, Miss Kathy Holloway Hill and Mr. Tony Lamont.
Good evening, good evening. You have Kathy Holloway Hill here with you this evening.
And I'm Tony Lamont.
And we are so excited for you to join us this evening. We have a fabulous show on tap for you. You are going to be so happy to talk and hear from one of the most world-renowned film stars that you could ever imagine. Mr. Eric Braeden will be joining us this evening. And Tony, I tell you, I am so excited to have Mr. Braeden. I am one of his biggest fans, and I'm sure he has millions, millions, millions of other fans. So we are going to have a fabulous time this evening.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm a big fan also, so, yeah.
I know that. And I know my listeners know Mr. Braeden as the infamous Victor Newman on The Young and the Restless, but there are so many film credits to Mr. Braden's in Mr. Braden's career, and I'm so excited to talk about some of those with him this evening, and his most recent being The Man Who Came Back. So I'm very excited to have an opportunity to speak with him about that film, because not only is he the executive producer of that film, Tony, he's also in the starring role. So I'm really looking forward to speaking with him about that.
Yeah, you know, a lot of folks who do know about the movie industry or the industry of making movies know, you know, what the executive producer's responsibility is, but a lot of folks may not know, and that's really the person who makes the picture happen and puts the financing behind it and makes sure that everything stays on budget and actors are paid. So, you know, he took on the project himself and put the money in himself, and that's a big deal.
Absolutely. It surely is a big deal. And, you know, there are lots of credits to this gentleman. And, you know, like I said, I know we all know him as Victor Newman, but I tell you, Victor Newman is just but one credit that you can give to Mr. Braeden. He is a fabulous film star. And back in the 60s, and I'm excited to talk to him about that when we bring him on the line here, but back in the 60s, I remember him in the Rat Patrol.
Oh.
And,
I got excited.
I know that was one of your favorites. So,
that was my show. I would make sure I had to be home for the Rat Patrol.
Oh, really?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Yeah, a young man growing up, and you know, soldiers in the desert, and he was always the coolest guy. I mean, he always had a way of getting things done. And what was so amazing is he was playing the bad guy, but you didn't look at him as a bad guy. You really, really didn't.
Yeah. I know. I mean, that was a classic. To me, that was just, you know, absolutely fabulous. That was a classic. And, you know, I feel the same way you do. And that's one of his many credits. And, you know, he was also in Titanic. And I don't know, some of our younger fans may not remember the Rat Patrol, but I know they remember Titanic, because that was only maybe 10 years ago. Was that back in the mid-90s?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, yeah, he was also in that. So, yes, he has so many credits to his name. I mean, he has been on so many covers of soap opera magazines, and he's actually German-born. I'm sure some of you probably knew that. He was born in Germany, and his German name was Hans Gudegast. And I am so sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. But when we bring Mr. Braeden on the line, he is going to let me know if I mispronounce that. But I am going to go ahead and try to bring our wonderful guest, Mr. Eric Braeden, on the line here. And...
Hello.
Hello, Eric. Are you with us?
Hello, Kathy and Tony. Are you there?
Yes.
How are you,
sir?
Are you both there?
Yes,
we are.
Are you snowed in or what?
Oh, no.
Well, I am in Indianapolis. We are snowed in Indianapolis, where I'm calling from.
Uh-huh.
So yes.
Kathy,
yes.
You're where?
Oh yeah, I'm in Indiana as well, but I'm in southern Indiana, so we don't have snow yet.
Are you serious?
No, we don't have snow yet. It's coming our way, though.
Oh yeah. Well, you have to feel sorry for me because I'm sitting in 80 degrees weather right now.
Oh,
awesome.
My goodness. Just rub it in. Yes, just rub it in.
How are you, too?
We're doing wonderful. We're wonderful. How are you, sir?
Thank you. And thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thank you for accepting. Now, Eric, I just want to start off. I am so excited. You know, I have your movie, and you are the executive producer, and you're also in a starring role, The Man Who Came Back. Wow. I would like to just talk to my viewers, talk to my audience a little bit about that, and I'm really curious to know what prompted you to want to executive produce that particular movie, set back in the West and in the post-Civil War days. What makes you want to do that?
Good question, and it was a slow evolution. The original script was brought to me about 7-8 years ago. It was written by Chuck Walker, who was the only white guy on the U.S. Olympic boxing team during the time of Sugar Ray Leonard and Howard David and all those guys and Spinks. And I've always had enormous respect for boxers. And long story, we are friends, and he came to me with a script. He had been writing for a while. And I said, there's something in here that I like. It's a revenge story. And I easily identify with that. And then I mulled it over, and then over the course of about 2 years or whatever, I said, you know, this needs an historic context. If it takes place during Reconstruction in the 1880s in the South, I said, that's an historically very interesting time. So then I made him, I saw a film called Belisaire the Cajun, starring Armand Asante, and it was directed by Glenn Petrie, who was from New Orleans. And I thought that guy would be perfect as a director for this film. So I sent him a script, and he read it and liked what he read. And I said, however, I want to give this in a story context. I don't want to just do a revenge story. And pictures that have historic context interest me. So I said, I want you to read a book called Without Sanctuary. I don't know if you're aware of that book or not. Are you aware of it?
No. I just wrote it down. It's called Without
Sanctuary.
Okay.
Came out about 5 years ago, and it's a rather graphic book about lynchings in the South in the latter part of the 19th century, and where people came and used their cameras to photograph it.
Wow.
And I think they had an exhibit of it in New York for a while, and it closed after a week because they were afraid of, you know, of riots or whatever. So it was a book that was compiled by an antique dealer who, while going through various flea markets in the South, happened upon pictures of lynchings. And that's what they sent to each other sometimes and said, come to barbecue next week in Mobile, Alabama, wherever it might have been. And they came by the hundreds and photographed it. And this book is full of those photographs. It should be must reading, I think, in all American high schools. And, of course, it isn't. Because here in Hollywood, we'd rather talk about what happened in during 12 years in Germany than what happened here in 300 years. So, anyway, this historic context is what interested me. Then while researching that whole period, we happened upon the second bloodiest labor strike in American labor history, which occurred in 1887, I think, in Thibodaux, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And the nominally freed slaves were now asking for a dollar a day rather than 75 cents a day, and they wanted to be paid in cash or in money, real money, not in scrip. And they were joined by railroad workers, and they had 10,000 members in no time. And then they announced a strike, I think, on the 21st of November, 1887, if I recall correctly. And plantation owners got together with the militia from Shreveport, Lafayette, and New Orleans, and they used Gatling machine guns to mow down 300 of them, of the strikers. And I said, once I heard about that, I said, I want all of that incorporated into the script. And the writer-director did that, did a very good job. And so now, all of a sudden, that whole revenge story made more sense. And that's the genesis of this script. The Reconstruction period, as you know, was an extremely interesting period in the South after the Civil War, and a very difficult period. So I think
right.
one needs to throw light on that. And one needs to realize how far we have come. And now with the election of Obama, I think it's an extraordinary event in American history. Not that that needs reiteration, because everyone knows about that, but to me it's an extraordinary
event. We're going to get to that, too.
So that is the genesis of the film. And then I sent the script to some of my friends, George Kennedy, who I've always admired, who played my father in Young and the Restless. And
right.
Billy Zane, I did Titanic with him, and Armin Asante I knew, and Sean Young, who was in Blade Runner and some other films, I knew Sean. And Carol Alt and I had done something together. So I then two or three other actors were friends, and they liked the script, and there you are. We did it last year in Texas with a lot of help from a group called Women in Film in Texas, friends of mine down there, and we did the whole thing in 27 days, and it's a hell of a film.
Wow.
It's a hell of a film, I must say.
Yeah, you're right, and I'm going to encourage everyone. It's out, available on DVD,
That's right.
Eric, if you could just tell them where, I mean, I'm sure they could purchase it on Amazon.com.
Amazon.com, you can get it on, I forget all the internet things you can, on the computer you can do it, but you can do it at, you can get it at Walmart, you get it at Blockbuster, get it at various stores. It's just a riveting film, to be honest with you. It's a revenge story where I'm falsely accused, and they do things to my family, and then I'm being sent to prison and come out and kick ass. What can I tell you?
I love it.
Now, Eric, I do want to ask you, because you talk about the historical content, because you could have done this film a different way. It was so important for you to make sure that this country's history was a part of this movie, wasn't it?
Right, absolutely. Because, first of all, you know, sometimes I hear people say, well, we haven't come very far. I said, we've come an enormous... If race relations in America don't work, I've always said that, they won't work anywhere else. In other words, this is the country in which it has to work. And I've seen such enormous progress since I've come to this country in 1959. Enormous progress. So people who are naysayers who say there's no, they're wrong. They don't know the history. I mean, I remember it all, from Martin Luther King, all of that stuff, Civil Rights Movement, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act in 1965, all of that. But I think it is an important part of American history, and I think it's important to realize that we have come a long way. In other words, I'm basically an optimistic human being. I think there's hope for all of us. And that hope to me has always been America, to be quite frank with you.
Mm-hmm.
And but the dark spot in this country was always its race relations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have made enormous progress in that regard.
Go ahead, Tony.
I was just going to say, because you were talking about how the country has made such progress,
yeah.
And we'll elaborate a little bit more on it. But you mentioned, of course, everyone's talking about, you know, Barack Obama's election and
right.
where this country is. Just briefly, and then we can elaborate a little bit, like, how did that moment in how did it make you feel when that happened? How
well,
did it make you feel?
To be honest with you, I sat there with tears in my eyes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's as simple as it is. Because I have a number of black friends, Clarence Williams III from Mod Squad and various other things. He and I did a play in 1965 in New York on Broadway. He and I played brothers. We played brothers. We had the same father. And in a play in the Eugene O'Neill Theater in 1965. And we've been friends ever since. And I used to box in the ghettos here in L.A. For years and knew a lot of African Americans. And experience and know what they have gone through to a certain degree, and obviously I'm very aware of it. I'm politically very astute and very aware, And I think the progress has been just, I mean, phenomenal. And now culminating in Obama's election. So well, the reason why I was elected is a different story. We can talk about that. But it moved me to tears, to be honest with you. I thought, you see, America has all to immigrants, and I'm an immigrant. So are most others, except African-Americans didn't come here voluntarily. They were brought here. But most whites in America are immigrants, and they shouldn't very well forget that. And this country has always to immigrants meant freedom. It has meant all the things that are anchored in the Constitution, which I still think is one of the most extraordinary pieces of writing ever put together. So then to come here, as I did in 59, and see that a part of that population, a large part of the population, was not part of the democratic process, that sort of stunned me at the time. Mm-hmm. And I've always said, in all these years, I said, if blacks and whites don't get along in America, it ain't going to happen anywhere else, because this country has the foundation in the Bill of Rights, in the Constitution, that guarantees those freedoms, and that is basically respectful to all people of all creeds, all color, all religions, etc. So it is now, has come to fruition.
Absolutely.
That's absolutely right. Now let me just jump back a second to The Man Who Came Back, your latest film. I'm really excited about this because, you know, I know most of the viewers know you from The Young and the Restless, but this film is so magnificent. I would like to know, are you working on any other projects that you're going to be executive producing? Do you have anything coming up in the future that we should be on the lookout for?
Well, I tell you, if I find out that this film makes money, then I'm on to the next one.
I know it's doing very well. I saw some of the statistics that it's doing very well. The sales
pretty,
are going through.
Pretty damn well right now. You're right, Kathy. Yeah. It's. I was very happy to see that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never leave Y&R. I don't intend to do that. I'm intensely loyal to that show. But I will every so often do a film once a year if I can, and if this does well, then I'm preparing the next one.
Excellent.
And I don't know what it will be about yet, but I'm looking at about two or three different scripts. So.
Okay, and you will be executive producing those and starring in them, or will you be behind?
Most likely, yeah.
Because we don't want to see you behind the scenes totally just yet. We still
no.
want to see that Eric Braeden strength.
That's nice. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate that.
No problem.
So you guys ask me any questions you want to.
Go ahead, Tony, because I'm anxious to find out.
Both.
I know you.
Yeah.
Well, he was born. You were born German, and I just
I was
want
born
to talk
in Germany
about.
During the war.
And your German name was Hans Gudegast.
Gudegast. You pronounce it very correctly, right?
Oh, good.
You bet.
And I want to know what prompted you to change your name. Was it Hollywood?
Well, yeah. I had, as you know, done the Rat Patrol with Hans Gudegast.
Oh, we loved Rat Patrol.
Thank you. And a lot of other things, and done Broadway play and all that. And then I starred in a film at Universal Studios called Colossus, the Forbidden Project. It's about computers. And it was a little ahead of its time. Science fiction film, but not so far-fetched, really. And Lou Wasserman, who was then the head of Universal Studios and the most powerful man in town, said, I want him to be in this film. I think he'll be great in it, but he needs to change his name. No one with a German name will star in an American picture. So I was doing a film at the time in Spain with Jim Brown and Burt Reynolds and Raquel Welch called 100 Rifles. And my wife and I, when I got the call, I was at once elated and at once dejected because I said, I'm not going to change my name for anyone, anything. And then I had discussions, long walks with my wife, who has always helped me in these kind of moments and reminded me that Kurt Jürgens and Max Schell and all those German guys have played nothing but Nazis over here. And I said, I don't want to do that. It's too dehumanizing. Mm-hmm. And So I finally agreed to change it, but I come from a little village called Bredenbeek. I took the first part, Braden, because I needed something I could hold on to, something that I could identify with.
Okay.
So there you are.
Okay.
That's where that came from.
Well,
it's called Colossus, the Forman Project. It's a very interesting film.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the name fits. The name fits well.
Thank you.
It's not Hans Gudegast, but it does fit well.
Yep.
Now,
I just wanted to ask you, Eric, one of the things that I've noticed, I mean, you've done various genres of films and motion pictures, and as you said, you've done Broadway. You've done a little bit of all kinds of different kinds of genre. Do you have a favorite genre to do when it comes to your acting?
That's a good question. I did Shakespeare for a while. I have enjoyed that enormously.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's intellectually challenging, physically challenging, emotionally draining. It really challenges you to the utmost. If I had my brothers, I think I would probably like to do films where I'm largely in charge. Not to take over, not to direct, but to really have the final say, the final creative control, which I did in this film. And I tell you why, because I've been in the business since 1962, and I know more than I realized. And in the end, all these creative aspects of a film are questions of subjective taste. And I thought, you know, I'm going to put my ass on the line and decide what music I want in this and how I want the sound and how I want this or that. And that's what happened. And I enjoyed it enormously. I really did. So if I had my brothers now, I would continue doing exactly what I'm doing, namely do Y&R, to which I'm very loyal. And that has given me many, many things. And do a film or two a year. I would love that, but one that I can control. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Y&R is fabulous, and you know, of course, you have millions and millions of fans that love you on Y&R, and I know there was a time on Y&R when. Now I'm just going to be honest with you, Eric. I wasn't very happy with the role that you were playing. You know what I'm talking about?
I'm sure you weren't, nor was I.
Okay,
you know?
All right.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, it's when you do it for, I've been doing it now for 29 years.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, here and there, you run into writers who have different ideas about it. And nor did I like it sometimes. But generally speaking, I'm intensely grateful to this and loyal. Listen, there are 150,000 registered actors in Hollywood. Let's be real for a moment. 150,000 registered actors in Hollywood, divided between the Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. These two unions comprise 150,000 actors, of which 1% make a living. Are you figuring out?
Wow.
That's the stunning reality.
Whoa.
And it's a brutal reality. So when you are in the position that I'm in, where I have been steadily employed for most of my career,
that's right.
I have to kiss the ground I walk on. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm a lucky man. I work very hard at it, but I'm a lucky man. Now, here and there, you do things you don't really like to do, but so be it.
Right.
Don't we all do that? Doesn't everyone do that?
Yes, we do.
Most people go to jobs they don't like. I basically like my job very much. I love acting. I'm still very fascinated by the process whereby you turn something that someone else wrote that you not necessarily always like and make it real. And that's a challenge I've never tired of. Never.
Well, you're very good at what you do. And I mean, was there any motivation for you? I mean, what steered you in that direction? Because you're very good at it.
I don't know. I honestly don't know what fascinates always has fascinated me from early on, from the earliest days. How do I make this real? How do you turn something that someone else wrote, make it your own? And that's essentially what acting is about, is to make it your own.
Absolutely.
Make it sound true, you know? So I don't know why that is. I don't even want to question it too thoroughly because I don't want to lose that. And I mean, when I go to the theater or when I go to watch films or television, I sit there, and obviously as an actor, I always look and I said, that actor or actress is very good. They're very
mm-hmm.
good. Or they're not so good. And
right.
That's a real moment. That's a phony moment. You know what I'm saying? It fascinates me. I don't know why, but it does.
Well, it's safe to say that you're pretty solid. I mean, you're pretty solid in what
Thank
you do,
you.
So you're fine. Go ahead, Tony.
Well, I was just going to say, Eric, there are. I know that we have some listeners not only on live, but we also have some that are going to be listening in the archives. And there are folks out there that do theater, and they're looking to break into the business, or they're looking to get some of, I guess, get their chops started.
Right.
What advice would you give them? Because the business, as a matter of fact, you were mentioning AFTRA. I'm a member of AFTRA because
right.
I do a lot of commercial work and have done some stage plays here
right.
in this market.
Right.
And the thing about it is I took some classes and I went, you know, to some sessions and did those kinds of things. But a lot of folks don't have that realness that you portray. They don't understand how important it is to make the role become you and you become a part of the,
right.
the role. So what advice would you give them?
Well, first of all, the things that you just were saying that you do, and I think to do it, in other words, do theater as quickly as you can, to go to classes where they allow you to do scenes, to just get a feel for that. And just get a feel for trusting yourself, and you know that takes a while to really trust yourself and trust your instincts, and because that's in the end the only thing you can rely on. I don't trust most directors. I don't. I'm not a very good listener to directors, unless it makes sense.
Yeah.
It is myself. I have to be happy with. You have to develop a sense for what is real and for what is phony. That's all there's to it. And I don't know how to say it any other way. It's. I mean, there's some actors, you look at them and say, my God, that is so damn good. I mean, who comes to mind, obviously, is the best of them all, as far as I'm concerned, is Meryl Streep. I mean, she's extraordinary. She's a genius, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But there's so many actors, from Gene Hackman to oh my God, there's so many wonderful actors around. And then there's some others that are not so good. How do you develop that sense? You hopefully have a coach or someone who constantly reminds you, you know, that the bullshit meter is on. You know what I'm saying? It's not true. It's not real. I don't know how else to define it. There's some people who have it, and there's some who don't. For example, everything, what's his name, Driving Miss Daisy, what's his name? The black
guy. And his name escapes me right now. Morgan Freeman.
Morgan Freeman. Everything Morgan Freeman does is real. Everything he does is real.
Yeah.
That man does not have an unreal moment. Not an unreal moment.
Mm-hmm.
He is brilliant. So Sean Penn, it's not an unreal moment. So the do you know what I'm saying? It's now there's a difference between doing what I'm doing on daytime, where you are faced. We shoot 80 pages in one day. 80.
Wow.
A film shoots about 2 or 3 pages a day.
Yeah.
So if you don't have your shit together doing a film, then you should leave the business. But try to do what we do. The most I've ever done was 62 pages in one day, I myself, from 3 different shows. And I do an average of 10 pages, 15 pages, 25 pages per script. So I personally do it. So in film, that almost never happens. So In other words, film actors have an enormous time to prepare for a role.
Right.
Enormous time to prepare for it.
Right.
We don't. We just go, bing, one take, two takes, that's it, boom. And you better be ready. So what that does is it makes you do everything more quickly in a more accelerated fashion. And conversely, it is a bad influence because when you do a film, it takes too long. It drives me crazy. Therefore, I need to do, when I do a film, I need to control it. I need to control other aspects of it. Do you know what I'm saying? In other words,
absolutely.
For me to just sit there and wait for the scene to be ready, I'd go crazy.
Right.
Because I'm so used to a fast tempo. You know, we work in such a concentrated fashion on Y&R, for example, that if I had not been involved in other decision-making processes on The Man Who Came Back, I would have been bored to tears. So,
and I think a lot of that, too, and I'm just going to kind of throw this in here, you know, when you ask that question, Tony, I think a lot of it, too, for me, is surrounded around passion. I mean, you have to have passion for what you do.
Oh, yeah.
And you can tell that,
Eric,
but you could tell Eric that you definitely have passion for everything you do. I mean,
I do.
Who Came Back, Victor Newman, every role that the Rat Patrol, Titanic, every role I've seen you in, and there are many. You've been in many films.
Yeah.
You bring a very unique strength to the role. So yeah, the
Thank
passion
you.
Has to be there.
So right, Tony, to answer your question, I would say. My advice to young actors is to really find out if they want to do it. To really find out if they want to do it. And not to do it because someone said, oh, you're so good looking. Don't do that. That's a kiss of death. A lot of good looking people out here in LA. You know what I'm saying? And when you
yeah.
have certain casting calls, and I mean, they had a casting call for the woman who played, Sabrina.
My latest
conquest, and there were, I forget, I think they interviewed 40 or 50 women, and all more or less beautiful. So it's such a tough thing. You have to want to act. You have to want to express deeply felt emotions. And by that I mean, I think underlying most creative processes, most artists' lives are based on anger, a lot of unresolved anger about their childhood, something in their childhood. And they have a need to express it, to share it with a larger audience. So, does that make any sense to you?
Absolutely, yeah.
It's that need. It's that need to engage people emotionally so that they understand you. What is art about? What are paintings about? What do writers do? Writers want to reach a larger audience. They're really shouting out. They're crying out. They're shouting out. They're saying, listen to me. I have something to say. You know, if you want to put it in those terms. That's what the artist does. That's what a creative person does. It's based on anger, wanting to get it out, shout it out, and wanting to be heard and understood. And my anger comes from many reasons. I grew up under bombs. When I grew up, they were bombing Germany every day, every night, for 4 years. The first 4 years of my life were bombs every day and every night. And I'm talking about the mother of all wars, the Second World War.
Right.
And people who haven't gone through it have no clue. They don't know. They don't know what it means to wake up one morning or get out of a bunker or a cellar or whatever that it is, and the entire city is flat. I mean flat, bombed to pieces, you know, with many dead, etc., etc. Anyway, so it was a tough life afterwards in post-war Germany when I grew up as a boy, and the thing that always saved me, and that's why I'm so emotionally tied to sports, the world of sports, has helped me a great deal. That's what really helped me, because after my father died, I literally lived in poverty. And what helped me was sports, all kinds of sports, from ice hockey to soccer to, in my case, most of it, track and field, discus and javelin and shot put, with which I won the German Youth Championship. And sports have always helped me.
And I'm glad you shared that, because that was my next question. I wanted you to share with your fans a little bit of your background as far as your upbringing and your childhood and you know, how that was, because I know you spent the first few years of your life in Germany.
Yeah.
So,
well, it was, as I said, first 4 years under bombs, every day and every night, and cities burning and animals burning and people dying and burning and... after the war, German soldiers coming back from the Russian front or not coming back, and with one leg and no legs and one eye or blind or whatever, and some of them were our teachers afterwards, and you know, it was a rough world. And I grew up in the country, so I worked on farms and during vacation to earn a living. And then my father, who I was very close to, passed away. We were four boys at home. We fought all the time, and if we didn't fight ourselves, we fought others. And beyond that, you went to school, and you worked. And then I got involved because I had four brain concussions from ice hockey and soccer and various other things. I started doing track and field, and my disciplines were discus and javelin and shot put. And we won the German team youth championship when I was 17. At 18, I wanted to get the hell out of there, and I had a cousin who lived in Texas, in Galveston, Texas, and she was a doctor, was a brilliant woman. She came from Hamburg. She had emigrated to America in the early 50s, and she sponsored my trip to America. And this is very interesting. I remember in 1958 going to the American consulate in Hamburg, applying for papers to come to America, and 50 years later, last year, I went back to that consulate. I was honored in the city of Hamburg, and the American consulate invited me, and you know what we showed? I showed them the film, The Man Who Came Back.
Wow.
That's 50 years later. Yeah.
Excellent.
And
full circle.
Yep. Full circle. Exactly.
That's
so, but... You know, I've always been, from the world of sports, it taught me to always be hopeful, to always look forward to improving myself endlessly.
Right.
In other words, you primarily in track and field, you're always concerned with throwing a little farther, jumping a little farther, running a little faster. And you never let it be, if you don't do well, you go out and you train harder to improve yourself. Mm-hmm. And that is what sports has taught me, to always... Don't rest on your laurels. Never rest on your laurels. Always improve. Always come out. Always fight. Always work on yourself. Always be modest about your accomplishments, but keep on working at it. And that I just, you know, I work out nowadays twice a day, usually, and it's in my blood. I need it. I need
that's,
it to...
That's great.
To,
that is really wonderful to know, because health, that's one of the areas that we really focus on my show, Eric, is health, self, and wealth. And health is so very important, because it doesn't matter what age you are. I know people say, well, I'm too old, or this or that, or I'm not healthy. Well, that's how you get healthy, is to continue to work out daily.
You bet. Kathy, let me put it this way, and I'm sure you have experimented with it, you and Tony, and I have, I know. When you are down and out a little bit, and you keep on, certain things bother you, and you keep on thinking and thinking and thinking. Well, you don't solve a damn thing by thinking. Sometimes you really can get into a rut. And what do people do? They go to a doctor or a therapist, and they get pills. They get antidepressant pills or whatever. There's a very simple solution to that. The biggest philosophers in the world have not solved problems by just thinking. They haven't. They're still arguing about everything. There's an immediate palliative, an immediate solution to these problems, that is to work out. Work up a good sweat. That creates certain hormones. Certain hormones will be produced in the brain that are oxytocins and all kinds of
endorphins.
Good hormones that make you feel good. You sweat. You feel you did something. Food tastes better. Everything you do is better
right
after working out. And it's so simple. We are not meant to simply and only think. That would drive us crazy. We need to do and think. But we need to do. And in today's world, you know, physical labor has been taken out of most jobs. We don't go on farms anymore and work our behinds off, where you have no time to afterwards ruminate about this or that. You're just so exhausted. Well, in today's world, we work out. You join a gym or take long walks. Just tire yourself. Breathe hard for a while, half an hour or 40 minutes, and you'll feel fine. It solves a myriad of problems.
Yeah. And, Eric, if you don't mind, I am going to just go to phones because we are live, and I want to take a caller here because I know I'm not going to take a lot of callers because, you know, I do want to try to get in, you know, some more discussion with Eric. So we're going to bring area code 480. 480, you're on the line with Eric Braden. Do you have a comment or a question?
Eric.
Yes.
Can you hear me? This my name is Bridget, and I'm calling to just
thank you.
Hello. Thank you for being so authentic and so real and sharing your personal life as well as your professional life. I'm very impressed with who you are as a person and all that you have to offer the world. I'm to be honest, I'm very impressed. I did not expect you to be so real and genuine. And knowing Kathy, I should have known that's all she would have involved in her and with her life, but I think you're wonderful, and I'm kind of curious, what is the greatest area of growth in your life from your experience as an actor, as a person, or what has helped you become a better person?
That's a very, very good question, and I would say that the single most important thing in my life as a person is to have been a father, and I would say that is the most emotionally satisfying, challenging thing I've ever done. A wonderful son, very close to him, and now to be a grandfather is even better. To a beautiful girl, and she is absolutely adorable. And, you know, life, I've been married to a wonderful woman for many, many, many years, and it's life in all of its vicissitudes, you know. It's tough sometimes.
Right.
We all have emotional ups and downs, and we all have, you know, relationship difficulties sometimes, and you just... Yeah, I would say that, and you know, I've never really reached a point where I sit back and say, you know, I've now solved it. I haven't. I've been very lucky to have made a good living in this profession for as long as I have, because one thing I know for sure, all of what I'm saying goes right out the window when you don't have a job. That is the toughest thing to deal with. Poverty and not having a job, that's a tough thing to deal with. And it used to be mostly tough for men, but now it's for women as well, because women are in the workplace. And when you no longer work, you lose a sense of worth. I don't give a damn how mature you are. That is the toughest thing to deal with. And that's why I want an Obama in power, because I think he's aware of that. I think he's very aware of that, because we desperately need a policy that makes sure that people are reemployed. I'm telling you, because that is psychologically the most devastating thing there is.
And I have goosebumps as you say that. I was a stay-at-home mother for 13 years. I didn't need to work. I left my husband because I had no passion, no life, there was nothing. I was living day by day, moment by moment, but there was nothing that was motivating me in my life. And I left him, went back to graduate school, started working full-time, and it has been the toughest thing I've ever done, but I've never been happier. So I totally agree with you. And my passion is helping.
What did you study?
I have my master's in marriage, family, child therapy, and many degrees, and putting them to use, hoping to help women, families avoid situations that I was trapped in. And I really believe that everything that you said is so real, and I appreciate you sharing that, because I think a lot of times people that aren't actors or in the light, we look at you and think everything's perfect. But I truly believe that, and this is on my website as well, that that to truly find ourselves, we must first lose ourselves. And I've definitely lost myself. And I appreciate you sharing your being vulnerable and different things that you've gone through. And I'm very, very impressed with you. So I thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We
really appreciate your call. And, you know, you're fabulous. Thank you for that question. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Bridget.
Okay.
Now, Eric, I do want to ask you this, because you mentioned about the employment piece, and you mentioned about Obama. And there are so many people right now that are in the situation where they are unemployed, and they're facing so much devastation in their lives. And coming from, we've heard your background and what you had to face, talk a little bit about what it takes inside to get past that, because it really, everyone has it, and we talk about it on the show all the time, but sometimes it's hard to find it within yourself. What was it that made it happen for you, and what advice could you give to those individuals that you just spoke about that don't have those jobs, that are facing those hard times?
That's a very, very good question. You hopefully have a spouse or someone close to you who will constantly reassure you that you are worth it, that you are good at what you do if you had a chance, that these are circumstances beyond your control, and that things will change again. You need a support group, you need someone to encourage you, and you need someone to remind you that you are good at what you do or what you did, and you lost a job beyond your control. And there are these few moments in life where you really look into yourself, and these are lonely moments, but they're very important, where you say, you know, let's look at this very objectively. Why did I lose my job? Well, lost my job because, in the case of the Midwest or Detroit area, Michigan area and all that, is because the car companies are in dire straits. Is that my fault? Nope. Am I still a worthwhile person? You bet. I am still, if you are fathers and mothers, you are extremely important to your children. Extremely important to your children. So, and other than that, you go into survival mode. You know, you do everything you can to survive. And there's nothing wrong with starting a job that may be lesser than what it was before. There's nothing wrong with that. Work is ennobling. I don't care what kind of work it is. It is ennobling. And sometimes you have to bite the bullet and say, you know, I now got to do a job that I don't really want to do, but I got to do it. I got to survive. I got to feed my family. And I grew up under circumstances that were, there was nothing after the war. I mean, talk about poverty. It was destroyed. There was nothing. So I seen too many people around me at that time pull themselves together and say, okay, let's work. Let's go for it. And if you can find the work, that obviously is the question now. So we hope we did. I think elect. Not only do I think so, I know so. We elected the right man, and I think together with the cabinet that he is surrounding himself with, and with people in the country who have sobered up about having lived beyond their means, I think we are now going to take the bull by the horns, and I'm very hopeful, I really am. But I think the most important thing for husbands and wives is to support each other in this time, is to not put the other person down. because they've lost a job, and to understand, if, for example, the man lost his job, for the wife to understand, that's the hardest thing for the man to deal with. Because let me tell you, in my opinion, when a man, or nowadays women who earn a living, but when a man is without a job, his whole sense of self-worth is, you know, self-respect is so tenuous. It is based very often on how well we produce on the work
right.
job. So we need, if you don't have that, understand why the man is in a bad mood, understand why he blows up, understand why he's emotionally upset, understand it. Because it's the toughest thing for a man to go through. Without a job, whatever you do, it's worth half of what it normally is worth. Does that
right.
make sense to you?
Absolutely, and I'm glad you said that. Absolutely.
I'm glad you said that too, Eric. Actually, you said that for you answered Tony's question, and you also mentioned that when the caller came in and made her comment, and I'm really happy that you put so much value in family, because that's what we represent here on the Living by Design show, because we want to empower people to understand that family and support system. I mean, we all get caught up in our pity parties at times in our lives.
Do we ever?
We really do. We really do.
Do we ever?
And yeah, and instead of pushing family back, pushing them away and saying, leave me alone, I want to just, you know, wallow in myself, woe is me.
Yeah.
We need to embrace our families, embrace our support systems, and I am just so happy that you reinforce that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, but you know, we need a national policy right now that creates public works programs and et cetera, et cetera. So, and we will. There's a silver lining in all this.
I've got to ask you this because you we've talked about politics and family, and now we're talking about the country, and I just want to know this because I was going to go and I can't go because I do have to work because I'm doing a broadcast show. Are you going to have the opportunity to attend the inauguration?
No, I unfortunately don't. I unfortunately don't. And I was just joking with friends last night. I mean, you couldn't get within 10 miles of that place, I don't think, because everything is booked. Everything was sold out.
Right.
And what I love to, am I deeply, deeply touched by his election? You bet. Now, was I initially for Obama? No. I was for Hillary Clinton. And I'll tell you why. Very simple. I thought Hillary Clinton, of all the candidates, was the most qualified. Mm-hmm. Until she made some egregious mistakes in the campaign. And when she started talking about landing in Bosnia under a hail of bullets, and we found out that wasn't true, I thought, what is that all about?
Right.
And then what I disagreed with completely in her campaign, and I've always liked Bill Clinton, to be honest with you, but why the hell was he always standing in her background?
In other words, absolutely.
It was antithetical to her proving that she could stand on her own. Of course she can.
Yeah.
But why the hell did he always stand in the background?
Right.
In other words, it disproved that point.
Right.
And but I had no doubt about her capability, none.
Mm-hmm.
About Obama, I knew too little. But boy, oh boy, did I change my mind when I watched him. He is a very tough character. He is a tough man. He's a tenacious man. And he is what impressed me the most, to be honest with you, is that he is not someone who's easily aroused to anger.
Right.
I mean, I so admired that because I tell you, my temper, I'd fucking hit back, you know, immediately.
Mm-hmm.
I would just hit back. And I watched him, and I thought, this man is so in control of himself. And then what impressed me afterwards, to be very honest with you, is Michelle Obama. She was interviewed once on Larry King, and I thought, this woman is so impressive. There's something so healthy about those two and their family. It's just healthy. I hope it stays that way. I think it will. And what I primarily also liked is that they both came from tough backgrounds, and they made it, and they have empathy with a lot of, you know, if you come from a poor background, that does not necessarily mean that you always stay empathic and fear for other people. It doesn't always mean that. I've known people who grew up and they become ruthless and tough, and that's not the case with those two. They have made it, and they never forgot where they came from.
Absolutely.
And that is so important, and I just, I just am very impressed with his, obviously with his brightness. He's an extremely bright, but she is extremely bright as well.
Right.
So I just have a very good feeling, to be honest with you, a very good feeling about those two. And he is very cool about the way he chooses cabinet now. Unfortunately now, in the vetting process, you know, here and there you forget that someone employed a woman who wasn't totally legal or whatever, or someone underpaid $3,000 worth of taxes, whatever the hell it is.
That makes it difficult when your commerce choice has some IRS problems. It does make it a little difficult.
Of course, but I mean, it's who hasn't had IRS problems? Give me a break.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I mean, do you understand the tax code? I don't.
Right.
I mean, you just, you know, you fly by the seat of your pants. You do the best you can.
Yes.
I usually overpay to avoid any kind of audits. But I mean, it's the tax code. Please, that should be simplified immediately. We should have a flat tax of one kind or another, period.
That's true.
Without exception. No exception, no deductions, nothing. A flat tax. Lower it and apply it to everyone without exception. Anyway, that's my opinion on that. So.
Well, Eric, I just want to tell you there are so many people in the chat room. This is a live show. We have people call in, and we have people that are in the chat room, and they're just sending out loves and hugs and kisses, and, you know, someone asked, were you married, and
yeah,
just all different types of things, and
yeah.
Yes, Eric is married. He's
yeah.
happily married, and you've been married
yeah.
for how long?
Oh, it is now over 40 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That is so fabulous. And I know you
yeah.
have one son and
yeah.
one granddaughter. That is
that's
so
right.
precious.
That's right.
That's wonderful.
She's just
the light of your life, I'm sure.
You bet. You bet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, grandchildren. I'm a grandfather also, and I've got a grandson and a granddaughter. And,
oh, my
and,
God.
And, yeah, I understand what you're saying. It's a completely different feeling.
Isn't it?
It is.
I mean, it is. You know, now I had a son. And growing up in the world of sports and with three brothers and always just in the world of sports and hard knocks, when you have a son, I'm very close to him, but, you know, you want him to, I took him down to the ghetto gyms very early when he was 7 years old. I wanted him to really, and with and you're sort of disciplinarian a little bit, mm-hmm. with my granddaughter.
She's got you wrapped around the finger already,
oh,
huh?
Oh, my God, I tell you. I do things for her that, I mean, we play hide and seek, or my God, she makes me do the silliest things.
That's
but
so
I,
nice.
I do them,
so
you
nice.
Know? Yeah.
Now we're coming down on our last 2 minutes, so I just want to, and, you know, I know I didn't get a lot in about Young and Restless, but I did just want to say that, of course, I've been watching you for the entire 20-some-odd years since you've been in that role, and you're fabulous. And I'm glad to know that you will be staying in that role and you
oh,
won't
yeah.
be going anywhere. So hopefully we'll have some great surprises coming up here in the next
year. I have a feeling we will. You know, it never – Victor's always up to something. I mean, but do I always agree – with what is written for me? No, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
But is it my responsibility as an actor to do the best with it I can? Yes.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So,
and Eric, I am going to, you know, be going ahead and saying goodnight here because we're down to our last. I can't believe this went so fast, but
too
I knew
bad.
It would.
I enjoyed it very much. We're both very nice people, and you have asked some very intelligent questions, and I enjoyed it very much. I really did. Anytime.
Well, we enjoyed you, too, and we really appreciate you accepting our invitation, and you're a very
yep.
gracious gentleman, and I just...
Anytime you want to talk, call up my publicist and we'll talk.
I really appreciate that.
And Indianapolis, by the way, is a very beautiful town. I've been there two or three times for the Indy 500 and then for the Formula One Grand Prix.
Absolutely.
And it's a beautiful town. Very nice time.
Well, we'll have to get together next time you come here, then.
You bet. All right?
All righty, Eric.
Thank you very much,
thank
Tony.
You all. Thanks so much, Eric, and thank you all for joining us this evening. We are going to sign off. I am Kathy Holloway-Hill.
And I'm Tony Lamont.
And I'm Eric Braden. saying goodbye.
And Mr. Eric Brayton, thank you so much, everyone, for coming tonight. And we will see you next week at the same time. Good night, everyone.
I appreciate it. Good night.